I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Friday, March 26th. Let's get right to Senator Kirsten Gillibrand. New Yorkers, you're invited to call your senator. Anyone else may call too, from blue states, red states, purple states, and any other color states. Just make your calls relevant to things that the U.S. Senate is dealing with. I'm going to start with voting rights and the filibuster that stands in the way. And you think the COVID relief bill was big? Here comes the Biden infrastructure bill, we're told, which could be $1 trillion or more bigger. And hello, Senator Gillibrand. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hello. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for asking. I'm going to get right to it. Are you ready to vote to abolish the filibuster so that only 51 votes are needed to pass voting rights or civil rights legislation?
I personally am prepared, and the reason why is because we have so many urgent areas of crisis that have to be addressed immediately, and frankly, all we've seen from Mitch McConnell has been obstruction. I think we will continue to see that obstruction. And I've been working on this voting rights bill with John Lewis before he passed for over 5 years, and what's happening in these states across the country to truly take away people's civil rights and civil liberties and making it much harder to vote is so anti-democratic that we may have to respond in this way. I would love us to be able to govern effectively with a 60-vote threshold and have bipartisanship in all things. But I've really seen Mitch McConnell close ranks, and you saw it in the first COVID relief package that should have been widely bipartisan, and we are likely to see it in the next COVID package, which is probably why we'll do that again through reconciliation.
Well, you mentioned McConnell. Republicans object to a variety of provisions in the For the People Voting Rights Act that they don't want the federal government to impose on the states. Here is Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell with two of them.
From here in Washington, popular policies like voter ID requirements would be banned unless states neutered them with loopholes. Meanwhile, unpopular and absurd practices like ballot harvesting, where paid political operatives can show up carrying stacks of other people's ballots, would not just be allowed, it would be mandatory.
So did Senator McConnell describe those provisions accurately, and how would you defend taking those decisions away from states or things like ballot harvesting, as he labeled it, allowing paid operatives to collect ballots at people's homes?
So I think what he's talking about is a lot of the reforms we put in place to help with COVID. And be clear, he's also opposed to issues like early voting and vote by mail and making sure Saturday and Sunday voting is allowed. So he's against all of it, and I think he's trying to demonize accommodations that were made for people that needed help during COVID to get their votes mailed and to get them actually counted. And you can tell by the language he's using, the fact that he's saying harvesting ballots. I mean, that is charged language that makes it sound like these are created ballots, that these aren't real ballots. It's a dog whistle, and I think he's trying to infer or imply rampant voter fraud. And none of these measures are have shown to have any impact in undermining voting rights. In fact, they lift up and help make sure people can access their voting rights.
So how far would H.R. 1, Senate Bill 1, go? So, for example, for people who haven't heard this yet, the Republican governor of Georgia, Brian Kemp, just yesterday signed a new law passed by the Republican legislature that does things like seriously shortening the length of a runoff election period. Of course, that's now the two Democrats won in the Georgia Senate runoff, and reduce the early voting period, for runoff elections by two-thirds. It takes administration of elections away from the Georgia Secretary of State, who we know has been sort of a principled nonpartisan actor here, though he's a Republican, and gives it to the partisan legislature. And it even bans bringing water to people who are standing in line at the polls in any election. I guess that's because the lines tend to be longer in urban, red, black, and Democratic areas. so bringing water might be more relevant to them. Would your Senate Bill 1 ban everything that Georgia just passed?
I don't think so. I don't think there's anything in For the People Act that relates to having water be delivered. I think this bill is far more about ballot access, preserving the integrity in voting systems, demanding accountability in election administration. It does modernize the voter registration system. So, for example, it would let people register online, which is something that's already law of the land in states like South Carolina. And I tried for many years to get the South Carolina senators to co-sponsor even that one provision with me because it's already the law of the land in their states, and they declined. It will ensure ballots are counted from Americans serving in military and overseas, allow same-day registration, notifies voters when voting changes are made, assist voters with disabilities, restore rehabilitated citizens' right to vote. These are big, sweeping access issues. And then integrity issues are things like counting all provisional ballots, provide informed and reliable poll workers, protect voters from deceptive practices and intimidation. So that's how we would ensure integrity. And then last, just accountability, create a national voter hotline to report problems, ensure votes are counted correctly, and reauthorize the Election Assistance Commission. So I think, again, I think he's trying to create red herrings and trying to imply that what we're trying to do is somehow nefarious, is part of Donald Trump's effort to create another big lie and to extend the big lie. So, again, this is what I'm very concerned about, that Mitch McConnell cares more about politics than he cares about our democracy. And we've heard from Republican legislators across the country that their intention is to make sure that they win elections and that Democrats' votes aren't counted. So I think they are being very disingenuous and harmful.
One more thing on this, then we'll move on to calls and other issues. If you're now going to federalize election law, what's to stop the Republicans the next time they have control of Congress from enacting the voter suppression provisions like we see them pushing through in states like Georgia? Like, we know that many black churches have what's called souls to the polls voting trips after church on Sundays. They did not get the provision to ban Sunday early voting through in Georgia. We had talked about on the show that they were trying. That's apparently not in the Georgia law, thank goodness, so they can still do early voting on Sundays. As of now, here's Republican Senator Cindy Hyde-Smith of Mississippi, however, speaking in a Senate hearing this week, supporting the idea of banning early voting on Sundays in particular.
Remember the Sabbath and keep it holy. So that is my response to Senator Schumer.
Never mind the Establishment Clause of the Constitution, but if you're going to federalize election law, I imagine the Republicans will say you've given them the basis on which to pass their version of an H.R. 1, Senate 1, next time they control Congress, or tell me why not.
No, you're absolutely correct. This is why the debate over the filibuster is so important. We do run grave risks that things we care about will be undermined when we are not in power. And I've spent the last 6 years in the minority. I know what it feels like. It's not fun. And I was very angry when Mitch McConnell changed the voting threshold for justices to 51, because I thought a Supreme Court justice should at least be able to garner 60 votes, since it's the highest court in the land and since it is an appointment for life. And so this does have very significant downsides, and everyone needs to be aware of it. It's why not all communities are supporting the filibuster reform. Women's rights will be at grave risk. LGBTQ rights will be at grave risk. Clean air and clean water will be at grave risk. And so what we saw under President Trump is what he was able to do just as president through executive order. If you watch what he did in the first three, 6 months of his administration, he banned transgender troops from serving. He harmed LGBT rights across the board. He immediately allowed polluters to pollute in almost an unrestricted way. He immediately put in place a Muslim ban. And so if you have a Congress or a Senate that's as conservative or extreme as President Trump, they will do those things. And so, again, everyone must understand, be careful what you wish for. This is not an easy decision. It is a hard decision. But I believe, given how urgent the crisis is right now, that we do have to do everything we can to preserve voting rights, which is why the Voter Empowerment Act is so important. It's why we need it for gun reform, since how many gun deaths do we have to see in New York State and around the country? And that includes at least doing three things: the assault weapons ban, the background checks, and the anti-trafficking bill. Because the assault weapons ban and the background checks will prevent large shooter attacks, and the anti-gun trafficking will prevent some of the day-to-day gun crime that destroys black and brown communities in our state in New York, because too many guns are sold out of the back of a truck that are trafficked from in places like Georgia that has less severe gun laws to places that have better restrictions like New York.
Laura in Manhattan. Laura, you're on WNYC with Senator Kirsten Gillibrand. Hi there.
Hi there. Hi, Senator. Thanks for taking my call. I was thinking about this in terms of what has happened recently, and I do come from gun culture. I have family members who are very responsible gun owners. And whenever we get into this conversation, it gets to be very volatile because of terminology that is used inaccurately. And I just noticed that you were using the term, again, assault weapons. There's really, when you talk to a gun owner, assault weapon is really not the term to be using, because there's really no such real terminology as an assault weapon. All weapons can be used in assault capacity. So often the style of rifle that is being targeted is an AR-15 style rifle, because they look like military rifles, such as the M16, but they function like other semi-automatic civilian sporting firearms. They fire only one round with each pull of the trigger, and they are basically a template, if you will, for a kind of rifle. So the main difference between an AR-15 and other semi-automatic rifles is the vertical grip and the versatility of customization. And that's really it. So if your conversation starts out with trying to ban AR-15s, when you get somebody who is a gun enthusiast or a law-abiding gun owner, the conversation stops because the terminology is incorrect and the understanding is incorrect. They will also point out to you that pistols are far more used in gun deaths. So why target specific weapons such as an AR-15 when they are not used in the most gun deaths in this country?
But let me get a response. Senator, what do you say to Laura? She's being very specific there.
Laura, you are well informed, and as are your gun enthusiast friends and family members. The reason why we use the general term assault weapons is we want to ban the military-style weapons that are designed to kill large numbers of people very quickly. And so it is meant to be not it's not intended to take away people's ability to buy the hunting rifles that they want, to buy the kind of guns that they would want to have in a home. But this is serious issues. AR-15s are designed for the military and are used by the military. If you are a member of the military, you will be trained on that weapon for years. It is not something that should be able to be bought easily. It's something that requires significant training, and it can easily be changed to be able to emit large numbers of rounds quickly. That's the design of those weapons. That's why it is designed the way you just described. So we're trying to keep the kinds of weapons that a shooter, which we've seen in these gun deaths in the last several years, could easily access, a shooter with grave mental illness, a shooter with terrorism in mind, to acquire that weapon easily and be able to use it. That's what the ban's about, because we're not trying to undermine law-abiding gun owners. We're not trying to undermine hunting. But there's some weapons that really should be reserved for people who are highly trained, and that's our military. And that's why we use a simple term. But it's, I understand for people who know a lot about guns that it can be frustrating, but that is the intent of what we're trying to do. We have to stop the number of mass deaths that we've seen, and the simplest way to do it is to eliminate the guns that make that so easy.
Laura, thank you for your call. Obviously, this conversation continues around the country. Lorianne in Queens, you're on WNYC with Senator Gillibrand. Hello, Lorianne.
Hi, how are you? Okay, I have a question, really, well, a comment for Senator Gillibrand, who is calling for Governor Cuomo's to step down. Thank you. I'm nervous. And after what she did to Al Franken, without due process, how can she go ahead and do that? Now, I will preface the fact that I do totally believe that he's guilty, but let's have due process. That's where we live. That's what we're about. And I think it is a real shame of the Democrats to just, and I'm going to use this word loosely, crucify somebody because of what other people said. We do not do that. It's due process. And Senator Gillibrand already ruined Al Franken's life. So...
Lorianne, thank you. Senator.
Thank you, Lorianne. I appreciate your question because I have a chance to explain to you and hopefully all the listeners why that is not the case. First of all, everyone is entitled to due process. Everyone. Al Franken is entitled to due process. Governor Cuomo is entitled to due process. Those are the choices they make. Al Franken chose not to go to the ethics panel. He chose to resign instead. When senators, particularly senators who work with him, or senators who work in our state, or legislators who work in our state, we're not asked about that question. We're asked whether we believe the women who have come forward, number one, and if we do believe them, whether those mistakes or crimes merit someone to step down. And so we're not given the benefit of waiting 3 months when we're asked that question. We are just asked, do you think these allegations are credible? Do you think that if he did do these things, that these are the types of allegations that would mean he would have to resign? So we are literally just being asked for our opinion. And we don't have the luxury of saying, I'm not going to give you my opinion for the next 3 months. We don't. We just simply don't, because we make judgments all the time based on whether we believe something or not, whether we believe something's true or not. It would be far easier for me personally to wait 3 months, because I wouldn't have to be blamed, as you just did, for Al Franken's behavior. He's the one who groped 8 women. It wasn't just a photo. It was 8 women. And I waited for several weeks to say there's going to be an investigation. But when it gets to be 8 and it gets to be a repetitive set of allegations, and I then realize that one of the women who has alleged the groping is a member of the Armed Services. I sit on the Armed Services Committee. Then I find out one of the allegations is from a woman who works in the U.S. Senate. And then I hear that there's another allegation from someone at a fair, and another allegation, and they're all similar, I'm asked, do you believe these women? And if you do believe them, is that the type of behavior that should be tolerated? So I'm not, it's just an opinion. But Senator Franken, he gets to decide what he does with his life. It's his decision. So blaming me for his decision is wrong. It's what we do all the time. We blame women for the actions of men. And we blame women for voicing an opinion about it. So I am obligated in so many instances to voice an opinion because of my job. I wish I never had to voice an opinion because it puts me with enormous pressure of massive, backlash. And your statement is a perfect example. You're blaming me for Al Franken's 8 gropings. But I'm happy to do my job, and if I have to stand in front of a bus for 8 women who have been groped, which I did because I believed them, and I didn't want them to have to take that heat. It's part of my job. Okay, now the governor. The governor has 2 investigations going on now. He's got an investigation by Attorney General Tish James. She will do a thorough, transparent investigation, and the facts will come out. And whether or not any of these allegations are criminal will be investigated. They will do the work. And at the end of that investigation, they will make recommendations about whether there needs to be a prosecution, whether there needs to be some penalty or some punishment. That's their judgment. I'm not here to decide on penalty or punishment. I was only here to say, do I believe these women and do I think that conduct is inappropriate? And my answer is yes. So it's just an opinion.
But you called on the governor to resign.
I did, and that's my opinion. I think that I believe the women, and I believe these allegations rise to the level that he should resign. And mostly, especially now, we're in the middle of a COVID epidemic, and we have just given $1.9 trillion to the states to restore this country and to help people who are suffering. And when your job has to be focused on solving these so many problems, I think it's very hard to do that job if you do not have the support of your governing partners, that you do not have the confidence of your assembly members or your state senator members. And so in light of that, and in light of the repeated allegations that are very similar in nature, and these are credible allegations in my opinion. That's why I made my statement, which is my view. But it doesn't mean that the governor or Al Franken don't deserve as much due process as they want before they're punished. I'm not punishing them. I'm just telling you my opinion. And that's what due process is about. Due process is a criminal term that's designed to say no one can be convicted of a crime and punished for that crime before they have due process. I'm not convicting anybody of anything. I'm not punishing anybody for anything. I'm just giving my opinion. And so now the governor has said, I'm waiting, which is his right, which Al Franken chose not to do. The governor is waiting. He's going to go through that investigation. That will probably take 2 or 3 months. It's going to take a long time. And he's going to wait for the assembly to decide whether or not to impeach him, and he'll go through that process. And all the while, all I want to do in my job in the Senate is just help people. I want to get this COVID relief money out. I want to help the small businesses that we heard about from earlier. I want to help the first responders. And so that's where we are. And I'm sorry that you think it's wrong of women to voice opinions or elected leaders to voice opinions.
And lastly, you have an announcement today, I see, as a member
about
of the
burn pits legislation.
Because you're on the Armed Services Committee. So people don't even know what a burn pit is in many cases. Tell us about this.
So during the global war on terror, the Army built massive open-air burn pits to dispose of waste. The waste include things like computers, electronics, equipment, chemicals, clothing, and they lit it on fire with jet fuel. And they burned those burn pits 24 hours a day. And our service members worked, ate, and slept near those burn pits. They breathed in these horrible toxins. And unfortunately, they came home with cancers and respiratory diseases. This is something I am very familiar with because the nature of what was burned in those burn pits is the same thing that was burned on 9/11. Because when the towers collapsed, it was electronics, it was building materials, it was computers, chemicals, all the same things. And so the type of diseases that these men and women who served in our military are getting are very similar to the 9/11 diseases. And so I believe that there needs to be a presumption that if you served anywhere near a burn pit and you are sick, that you are covered. We know from the 9/11 work that we can, over time, prove the links epidemiologically because we did it for 9/11. But I don't think we should be making our service members and our veterans prove that each time they get sick, because that's what they're being forced to do. We know that 3.5 million people have been exposed to burn pits. That's an estimate from the VA. There's 230,000 that have already registered as part of the burn pits registry, and thousands of service members were exposed at other contaminated bases that are very similar. So we know this is a population that needs support. And so any veteran who served as part of the Global War on Terror or the Gulf War would be covered. And having Marco Rubio as my co-sponsor is very important. The bill is bicameral and bipartisan in both bodies. And this is how we get things done. These men and women deserve to be covered. The fact that John Stewart is also part of this is very important. We also have another person of equal celebrity to the 9/11 community, John Feel, also advocating for this. And so we have a huge group of people, including survivors and spouses of survivors, that have advocacy groups. The Burn Pits Advocacy Group is extremely effective. And so I believe we will get this done. We're hoping we can get a hearing in the future, and we're hoping that we can get a vote on this bill in the next few months.
Senator, thanks as always. Talk to you next time. Stay safe.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Take care.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.